This is a Lip Media podcast.
This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The country we now call Australia was built on the stolen lands of hundreds of unique Indigenous nations, and we recognise that as white women, we continue to partake in and benefit from the act of colonisation. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging.
Slut. Welcome to Book Slut, a podcast bringing erotica out of the gutter and into a snobbier gutter. Hi, my name is Abby.
And I'm Sam. It should go without saying that this podcast is not safe for work, so put your headphones in.
Okay, so excitingly today we have our first proper guest.
Yay, legitimacy.
I mean, that means we've made it, right? So today we have with us Tegan Higginbotham, who is an Australian comedian, writer, and actress. Did I say your name right just then? Do you want me to say that again?
You did, and I know that was amazing. That's okay. The first time that's ever happened. Okay. And what's even really awkward is that I introduced myself to somebody the other day and I got my last name wrong. I went Tegan Higginbotham and it's a horrible last name. But thank you so much for taking it slow. It is phonetic. Like it's how it should be, but thank you so much.
So we wanted to chat with you today about, I guess, erotica and romance literature. That's what we come here for. And
I was here for sport talk. This is very upsetting.
I mean, our last episode was on hockey and we are bad at sport talk, so.
Yeah. So I guess to kick things off, straight off the bat, what was your first encounter with a sexy book?
You know what's really interesting is I'm finding out that this narrative is very common, and I've learnt this from listening to the two of you. For me, it was at a holiday house, somebody that my parents knew, and on their bookshelf was an erotic, it was a like proper Mills and Boone sort of book. And I don't remember the title. I just remember it was about cowboys. And
classic.
It was all set in a saloon and there was the big kind of angry cowboy and there was a woman and she was a virgin and then she had sex. And it was all explosions and fireworks. And, you know, since then I've really grown to hate the virgin narrative. Not hate virgins. I want that very clear. But virgin narrative in erotica. But, I remember just being just so scandalized and enthralled. And I'll be honest, completely turned on by this book.
How old were you?
That was, I'm going to say maybe 11-ish, 10-ish, 11-ish maybe.
Were you there? So you were there with your family?
Yeah, which is always the awkward thing because you discover this gold mine. And then you also go, oh no, this is a naughty thing. This is bad. I shouldn't be reading this, let alone get seen reading this. But other than that, I do recall things like, I remember at a very young age being very confused by the labyrinth, knowing that there was something more to that friendship.
Those pants aren't tight for a like non-sexual reason.
I don't think he wants to come to this place so they can be friends, but I don't understand. You know, and you know that there's something there, but you're just not sure what it is. So yeah, it kind of, but that, I remember that book was the moment where it really all, it all galvanized.
One of my most mortifying moments was when, because obviously I like reading. That's a thing that is well established by this point. My mum bought me a sexy book for like Christmas.
How is this the first time this is coming up?
Yeah, I know.
So you're a bit of an avid reader as well, aren't you, Tegan? You read.
I am.
Particularly around erotica and romance, though. That's what we've heard on the grapevine.
Yes. I like how you paused at the end of your sentence where you said, we've heard you like to read, as if that was in doubt. But no, I love a dirty book. I love them. I love them so much. I love a fancy, dirty book. I would have said that I do like a cheaper, dirty book, you know, a paperback, something that gets sold at the airport and you take on holiday and you're like, yes, this is great.
It's kind of like junk food, isn't it?
Yeah. I like to call them the hot chips of literature. You know that you can't have them all the time. But fuck it, you love it so much. A really good one that I read a little while ago, and I've not loved the others in her series so much, but there's an author called Joanna Bourne, and she wrote this book called The Spy Master's Lady. And it's this classic like drawing of a guy with his shirt open on the front. And he's, it's all set around these French spies and this, this particular spy, Annick Vier, I think her name is. And when you meet her, she's actually blind and she's been thrown into a prison with an English spy, like this, her, you know, her enemy. And it's just so over the top. And
there's already so much going on in that story.
Yeah. So she's blind. So she doesn't know, like she doesn't see him, but then of course they fall in love and they, you know, of they course. Get the dirty on. And then she manages to escape from him and she hits her head and she gets her sight back. And then little does she know, she runs back into gray again, but she doesn't know that it's gray. So suddenly she's feeling really guilty because she's fallen in love with another man. But
whoa,
it's the spy master. And it's such a great book. Oh my Lord. It's wonderful.
I feel like we're going to have to add that to our list.
Yeah. That's...
Please do. It's really something. It's really something. But then I also found myself just getting so angry with things like, you know, the big hitters, the Twilights and the 50 Shades and just how dangerous the messages were in there. Not just, you know, not just poorly written, but really concerning stuff.
Yeah.
It's a good combination when it's both poorly written and problematic.
Yeah. I didn't get past the first. I read the first Twilight in high school.
So word on the street is that you have, in fact, penned a sexy book.
Penned sounds so lovely.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? I imagine candles.
Yeah.
The scratching of quill on
paper.
Yeah,
exactly. I imagine ink, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. I've certainly given it a shot. And whether this gargantuan project that I've undertaken will ever bear fruit, I'm still not sure. It's out there in the world, hopefully trying to find a publisher. But I knew how much I love that just fun escapism of the hot chip sort of literature and how disappointed I was that I was just not finding really stuff that I was into. As I said, I'm really frustrated with virgins being put on such a pedestal in these sorts of books that I really love, especially because the how sex is portrayed for those virgins is just not accurate. It's not, you know, it's not great. It certainly wasn't great for me first time. By first time, I mean like the first 5 years. and then, you know, so that's never really gelled with me. And yeah, I've so many times really wanted to get into a book and then the lead female, she'll give up her job and give up her life because she's found the love of her life. And I can't connect with that. So I just wanted to try to write something that had all those really cheesy, fun, over-the-top tropes, but just a few tweaks along the way.
Yeah. Something that we talk about quite a lot is that so often we get just like snapped out of it because of all of these other things that come up, like the virgin trope that you mentioned, any kind of, you know, when they fall into traps about stereotypes about women and sexuality and whatnot, it just like immediately makes it certainly not sexy, but also takes away from that fun aspect that you are talking about. So I certainly applaud you for giving it a go. It sounds like a hard undertaking.
And it's been amazing, actually, with the amount of erotica and romance novels that Sam and I have now read, that there's honestly very few of them that I am like, this was an unproblematic, fun romp for, you know, for a woman to read and be aroused by. Like, almost every single one that we've had has just been on a varied scale of quite problematic.
I don't know if that's just because we're picking the books.
I've been trying to pick non-problematic ones. I pick ones with good ratings.
Yeah. One of the tricky things that I found was that, you know, when writing a hot sex scene, consent is really hard to write into it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be completely honest in that I have not read Normal People yet. I just went straight to the TV show. I was like, what is this thing that I'm hearing everybody talk about? Oh, but consent is done really, really well in that. And then juxtaposed between moments where there is no consent and, you know, it's really, really glaring. It's right in your face. But I found when you're in that and you're trying to create a rhythm and really build something, it's hard to filter in. And I can see why perhaps some people avoid that or don't write in condoms, because condoms are, I mean, there's just no universe where condoms are sexy in my mind. So putting those elements in, I found quite difficult. And it was through trying to do this and really look at it from lots of different angles and who do I want this lead character, this female to be? And, you know, yeah, it's funny when you then try and write it and some things I can almost see why people go, we just assume they put on a condom or, you know. you know, we're in her head, so surely she's, we can tell that she wants to say yes, you know, those sorts of things. I can see why it's skipped.
Yeah. And do you think that Australia and Australian, I guess, women, because it's mostly women who read these, have an appetite, like Sam and I in particular, have this appetite to find romance that doesn't jolt us out of it being sexy just because it has these things. Do you think that that appetite is there in the Australian publishing industry, for instance? Or?
I mean, I know that it is on a personal level with me, and I don't know if it's just the women that I'm talking to, but there's all the books that we read because, you know, they're in the media or they're really important, or, you know, because you want to look good when you post yourself on Instagram holding that particular book. But then there's also the ones that we all pass between each other. It's like, oh, have you read that one? Oh, no, that one was good. And generally it's because there is some sort of sexy or romantic narrative that, I mean, I get hooked by that stuff. I really do enjoy it. Whether that's being reflected in what publishers want to publish in Australia, I'm not so sure. I mean, I listened to you guys chatting about, and gosh, I'm kicking myself because I can't remember the incredible title of your Australian erotic fiction. Where was it? Was like in the Wimmera?
Wirralong. The Bride's Wirralong.
How could I forget the Wirralong? But I can't think of a lot of erotica or romantic fiction coming out of Australia, especially, and you're right, that's not set in that, you know, it was a sheep shearing station. Crikey, you know.
I mean, that's what I that's what I wanted.
Sam wanted more crikey.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a real shame, because I just fundamentally disagree with this idea that there aren't women out there who want romance and erotica that aligns with their set of values and aligns with their kind of worldview and is like modern and takes into account all these things. Like, it frustrates me that it seems to be slow on the uptake.
Well, that it seems to be it's not laughed at, that's not quite right. It's looked at like it's foolish, or that it lacks intelligence. I find that's something that there is this perception, like even chick lit makes it sound kind of poppy and fun, but I don't think it really encapsulates the breadth of literature that is out there that, you know, that talks about this sort of subject matter. It's just, yeah, chick lit. I don't know. I actually don't like the term chick lit. I don't really, that doesn't connect with me, but yeah, it's a real shame that it feels like this is still seen as it's not the legitimate literature. No, it never will be.
Yeah. And it's also like, it's incredibly hard to write sex, like what you were talking about. It's incredibly hard to write good sex. I think there is this disregard of good writing for sex because people are like, oh, it's just not important. Even though it's something that everybody thinks about a lot of the time, every single day.
I think it's the reason we make a lot of decisions in our life. I think sex, you know, I don't mean to, I'm sure that there are other things out there, but a lot of the time I think sex is really at the core of a lot of reason why mankind is the way it is. But you're right, trying to translate that onto a page is really difficult. What I find interesting though is when I find a book that has been written by a man and he'll nail something like a description of the female orgasm, and I'm like, who have you spoken to? And I get so intrigued by these conversations that must have taken place. One of them, and I just want to make sure I get I always forget his name, Jason Matthew, he did the Red Sparrow series. The film with Jennifer Lawrence and Joel Edgerton, it wasn't terrible, but it was in no way reflective, I think, of how good these series are. It's a really, really good series. And the sex scenes in it are great. And honestly, I keep going, man, you have had sex with a woman and then brought out a notebook and pen and gone, right, let's go. Step by step. What was that? What was that little noise? What was that all about? I feel like that's the only way he could have nailed it so perfectly.
Which hopefully would have made the experience more sexy, not just like really creepy and weird.
I love it when they take notes.
He just found someone who that was their kink.
Like, that was their thing, yeah. They're very good books though.
The only other thing that I wanted to ask you about, sort of like the experience of trying to capture that in writing, and I think like it's interesting talking to you because we obviously read a lot and critique a lot,
We've never tried to
write.
We've
never tried to write.
Maybe we'll do that one episode. Yeah,
that would be interesting. It'd probably be awful. But one of the things I'm curious about is, and that we've spoken about a bit in the past, is like the words that people use to describe body parts. And I'm curious how your experience was with that, and also like if you had any creative ones or ones you've come across in your readings.
There is no nice word for cock. It does not exist. For women, you can talk around it. You can kind of, you know, not that I would ever use her flowery garden, but, you know, it's a flowery garden and you can really get at it in a very abstract way. With the penis, cock, dick, phallus, manhood. Manhood's not bad, but it just is
clearly... What about like love sword? How do you feel about love sword?
Love sword. And then it's like, I don't want that near me.
Because the maypole, wasn't that one of them?
The maypole. That just makes me think of kids with ribbons.
Yeah, exactly. People dancing around it.
Yeah. And that was one of the definite tricky bits, is just there's no nice words. And I think that one of my troubles in life is my biggest struggle with sex is trying not to look at the things that I find funny.
Yeah.
To try and stay, like, erect penises are just funny. They're funny. And I don't understand. I was always really confused watching Sex and the City because Samantha Jones would be like, penises, yum, yum, yum. And I'd be like, but they're funny. Come on. This angry little thing looking at you.
Yeah, look, I've definitely been caught out laughing mid-sex before and been like, I promise I'm not laughing at you. It's just, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's, you know, so much of sex is ridiculous. And I think that when I was writing it, that was also tricky because, you know, it's quite ridiculous. But then, yeah, when you try to do things like, how do you describe an orgasm without just falling back on all of the old tropes, which I probably have. I'll be honest. They're probably just all the old tropes because it's really hard. It's really hard to do.
Hmm. I have a couple of examples from a previous episode that I'd love to run by you. Maybe you could incorporate them into your future work.
Yeah, there's going to be edits. So I'll bring out my notebook.
Okay, so this weapon of pleasure, which she staked herself upon.
Once again, that just feels like, and the sound, to stake oneself upon a weapon of pleasure, I just feel that's got to have like a certain splat to it, or I don't know, this, you know.
It also just feels like he's inert on the bed and she just like stakes herself on it, you know, like it's,
they're
just...
like, you're not meant to jump onto it, you know. Yeah, and I do find also, I mean, the manhood thing with, you know, with it being a weapon or a sword and all that sort of stuff to sheathe themselves, you know, within us. I don't know. I just get really like, oh, I get it. You wish you were a knight. Okay. All right.
And then talking about vaginas, we've got that dark and delicious deep. Now, you liked that one back in the day.
I like the alliteration.
Yeah, I don't mind. It's also just calling it a deep. It's so ambiguous that... it kind of works, dark and delicious deep. I don't mind that.
Cleft of flesh? How do you feel about...
Funny thing is, I've used the word cleft, and I know that I've used it because I had to look it up just to make sure that I thought it was what it was. But I used it more between the breasts. There's a bit of a cleft.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, a fleshy cleft just doesn't sound as hot, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it should be the fleshy cleft. That's what it
the
should
fleshy
be.
Cleft, the fleshy cleft. Oh.
So let's take a break, and then we will talk about Lady Chatterley's Lover.
Yeah,
which I'm so excited to talk about.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
All right, so essentially, Tegan, we asked you what you would like to read for this episode, and you chose Lady Chatterley's Lover, which I love. I read it in this age where I seem to have read every single book I've ever read, which is 15 to 18. but Sam has never read it.
Yeah.
Guilty. But you'd heard about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone's heard about Lady Chatterley's Love. Like, it's pretty well known, right?
Yeah. So I guess if you can take us through some of the major plot points, that'd be good. I don't really remember it.
I really loved revisiting this because I read it the first time and really, really loved it. And the second time around, and there were bits in it the first time that I didn't connect with and I found a bit jarring. The second time around, it's almost like I found new bits that I really didn't like. And there are a couple of things in there that are very of the 1920s where you go, that's not acceptable. And I'm going to just accept this as a historical piece that wouldn't be acceptable and, you know, sign of the times, blah, blah, blah. But I really liked revisiting again. So it's this incredible story about class and about how sex is just this equalizing thing between the classes, really. That when two people are in bed together and they have a good fuck, and you know, that's the sort of language that is in this book, that it doesn't matter who you are, it's just about that connection. And it's about this generation of people who have come out of the Great War, World War One, and have lost their identity in a little way, and they're shaken and they're struggling. And this, you know, these two people find each other in through sex, and that's where they find their relief. But basically it's all about this central character, Constance Reed, and we meet her right before she becomes Lady Chatterley. So she marries this, what would that be, a lord?
I think he's a lord. Yeah, I think he's a lord.
And I'm actually just going to hold with me for 1 second because I want to get to the very first line. I think really sums up what we're dealing with here. Mine's got this crazy long foreword, so I never know when the book actually starts.
I really froth a forward. Just
oh, really?
Yeah, I always read the forwards.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
So it starts off, ours is essentially a tragic age, so we refuse to take it tragically. The cataclysm has happened. We are among the ruins and we start to build up new little habitats to have new little hopes. It's rather hard work. There is now no smooth road into the future, but we go round or scramble over the obstacles. We've got to live no matter how many skies have fallen. So, you know, we kind of set off going, oh, all right, they've been through some shit.
They've got some issues to work through then, I guess.
They've got some issues. So as I was saying, you've got Constance, Lady Chatterley, and she was quite interesting. She was raised in wealth, but she was a bit of a bohemian, you know, with her parents. She traveled over to Europe and she's seen art and she's always been involved in intellectual circles and she just really respects intellectual connections. And she believes that this is what life is all about. It's about conversation. It's about having, you know, deep conversations and intellectual connections with people. So even her first lovers, who she has over in Germany, I believe it is, she doesn't choose them because she's sexually attracted to them. She just chooses the most interesting of the bunch and really doesn't think much of the sex at all. It's not her bag. Then she marries Lord Chatterley. He goes off to war and is shipped back home, paralyzed from the waist down. So everything is useless. So this young woman, she's in her 20s. Suddenly she is now locked with this guy who she will never be able to have sex with for the rest of their lives.
His dick doesn't work anymore.
Paralyzed. Yeah. Right. Done. So she's saddled up with this guy. And for a while, I feel like she doesn't even mind so much because she intellectually connects with him. And that is enough for Constance Chatterley. But the years go by and she's just living this really dreary life in this small town where it's a mining town. So industrialization is taking over. There's this real narrative about the countryside just becoming factories and soot and blackness. And then her husband, Lord Chatterley, suggests that maybe they could have a baby and Constance could sleep with another man because the sex doesn't matter. That won't come between their marriage. Their marriage is much more than this base human function, which is sex. And that's what the upper class is really personified. They're seen as being this sexless class in a lot of ways. And that really starts to rattle Connie, and she takes a lover and it doesn't quite work. And then not too long afterwards, we meet Oliver Mellors, the gamekeeper, former soldier, used to work in the mines. And if you want to have a picture of him, my Oliver Mellors has always been Richard Madden because of the BBC adaptation with Holiday Granger. Ring-a-ding-ding. But I found out that there was once an adaptation where Sean Bean plays, Bean as in Flicker. And
they always read his name as Scene Bean.
Scene Bean.
Every time.
So Scene Bean, really, if you want to picture Oliver Mellors, think young Patriot games, maybe, Scene Bean.
Yeah, right.
That's the one.
Because all I think is like older, kind of haggard Scene Bean. And I'm just like,
Give me a bit of that young Bean any day.
Oh, so Richard Nuttall's hot though.
Oh, okay. Just as a real side thing, because I am all about the Madden.
I just Googled his face.
What you've got to do is when we stop recording, you've got to watch this show on Netflix called The Bodyguard. Not Bodyguard, The Bodyguard. Oh, no, is it the other way? It's just Bodyguard. It's
yeah, the one I think that The Bodyguard is the movie, isn't it?
Yeah, which is also very good. It's so good. Anyway, I digress. You've got Oliver Mellors. Picture Richard Madden if you want. And he is so jaded. Oh my God, the chip on his shoulder. I'm surprised the man can lift anything. You know, and it's because, you know, as I said, this thing is about class. And it's this guy who went off and fought for England and he's actually educated. He's really bright, but because of class, he's nothing in their eyes. It's all about money, wealth, power, and he has none of it. And he speaks with this really heavy accent, even though he can speak the proper English. So all that and kind of like a sexy Hagrid in a way.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Now you're wet. Sorry, please. My God. And so Constance and him, as you can imagine, this love affair starts and he really awakens Constance because for the first time ever, she's having good sex and she realizes this connection between people and it's all about just how nothing else matters in this generation who are scarred and wounded and crawling out of the ashes of the first war. The kindest thing you can do to somebody is show them a caring fuck. Like you can be nice in bed. You can have good sex and a good connection. Connie eventually tells Lord Chatterley, she gets pregnant to Oliver Mellors. And there's this whole thing about her trying to hide who she's pregnant to because Lord Chatterley could deal with it if it was from somebody from the upper classes, but not a servant, not the lower classes. So they try to hide it. And in the end, the truth all comes out. And it ends on a really ambiguous note because Connie has to go kind of into hiding in a way. And Oliver Mellors does too. And he's
married as well, isn't he?
He is married.
I love that like the adultery isn't the thing that upsets her husband.
It's class. Exactly. Yeah. He doesn't mind that she slept with another man. It's that it was somebody below him. Again, it ends on this ambiguous note of, am I allowed to say how it ends?
Yeah.
Actually, the book's nearly 100 years old. Yeah. You've had your time.
The spoilers don't matter anymore, I think.
And of him hoping that they can be back together again soon, you know, once I guess the storm has died down.
Yeah.
And it's so rich and it's, you know, I can see why feminists even to this day pull it apart and fight over this book. And, you know, I know that people like Simone de Beauvoir cannot stand the writing of D.H. Lawrence. Germaine Greer is not a fan of the book at all. Like it really splits people down the middle. And I can see why it is contentious, but that wasn't the reason that it went to court.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I think I started reading some stuff about the language that D.H. Lawrence uses, which I obviously, because I read it when I was quite young and I remember struggling with Mellor's dialect and being like, what the fuck is this guy even saying?
Like, oh, is it written in a way that it like,
yeah, it's like he uses words like thine and like, yeah, really kind of dialect heavy words. But and now looking at that again, it's interesting. I read this whole article about the dialect, really, and about how he code switches so much between the Derbyshire dialect and then also the like proper English. And how in particular this one sex scene between him and Connie, when Connie, like when they start to really kind of bond and Connie uses the Derbyshire accent in response to him talking and he corrects her grammar in it. And so it's kind of like this entire power dynamic of playing with class in that way. And Connie being like acting as a servant towards him and doing all of that. And how a lot of feminists see that as, again, D.H. Lawrence. So I read a lot of things about how D.H. Lawrence just like never talks about foreplay. It's just always like a bit of
Now that you point that out, they are they're always pretty ready to go.
There's no warming up the oven.
And so the article that was talking about the dialect was actually talking about the scene where Connie's preparing tea for him as foreplay, like this idea of switching into these different roles,
it's being
being role playing and being this kind of BDSM kind of vibe to it as well, which I thought was really interesting to have this, just this total kind of code switch of this person and using that in a quite sexual way.
You're right, because I've always found his swapping between, you know, the dialects really fascinating, because he is such a broken person, Oliver Mellors, and I think he refuses to use the language that I actually think might even be more comfortable to him, which is a more relaxed style of English. He really seems to put on this thick accent as a form of defiance, because he doesn't want to be in any way associated with the upper class. And it's funny, I read that scene where Connie was taking on his dialect as something of a moment of humanity between them. Finally, they're actually playing and acknowledging this elephant in the room, which is, there's a pretty wide gap between us, but I can do your thing too, and you can do my thing. And we're actually, you know, we know that it's all a front, really. It's all show.
There's a great excerpt from the trial that the prosecutor says some of the dialect. And
So for context for people who don't know, there was a whole like landmark obscenity trial around this book, because it was originally published in 1928, but then the UK didn't get the full like uncensored version published until 1960, which was following on from this trial.
Yeah, so there's actually kind of two legal issues, like two ways that the legal system tried to stop this book from coming in. And the first was right at the beginning when it was published. So it was published in Italy and then it was smuggled into the UK. And it was published as, the reason that D.H. Lawrence ended up actually publishing it was because when it was first published in Italy, private erotic collections started publishing it, and he didn't get any of the royalties for it because he didn't have his name on it. So the next year he decided to publish it with his name on it, and then I think that was in France, and so that he could get the copyright for it. People started trying to smuggle it into the UK.
I love the idea of people smuggling books.
Isn't it great? Like it.
The border control, the British border control, had a seek and destroy order on it. So as soon as they found the books, they would destroy them straight up. Like there was just, that was what was happening. And so they tried to stop it from going into England. And then what happened in 1960 was Penguin wanted to publish it as part of their, you know, cheap books that you could buy. And that was when the famous obscenity rule kind of came in, and D.H. Lawrence was dead by this point as well, so it was kind of a posthumous trial of him. During that trial, one of the prosecutors read out some of the dialogue for it and was like, you know, kind of pointing out that this was just kind of ridiculous, I guess, and they were trying to pull apart, you know, like, oh, who would even read this? And in response to that was like, yes, that's the dialogue, but it sounds a lot better if you say it in a Derbyshire accent. So they're like, it's actually quite sexy if you say it properly.
Yeah, it's funny though. I mean, it felt to me like, and you know, this is somebody who wasn't there and hasn't done probably as much reading as yourself about the case, It sounds like they kept coming at it from this angle of, we have issues with the language, and not just the Derbyshire, you know, that strong language that's through there, but also use of the
four-letter words.
Yeah, are we allowed to say them on this podcast?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We love the four-letter words.
Fuck and cunt. And he really uses cunt in ways that I have just not really seen in literature before. And this case seemed to be focusing on that being the issue. But then this was from one of the prosecutors who wanted the book banned. And when it was finally said that it was going to be out there in the world, he was like, he asked if it was the kind of book you would wish your wife or servants to read. And I think that really it wasn't an issue with the language. It was about the fact that it portrayed women in a position of power that I've not seen in literature from that time too much. And also this class thread throughout it, it really just tore the upper classes to shreds. And I think that was the true issue, is that the upper classes didn't like being portrayed that way. I mean, there would have been people who bristled at the use of fucking cunt because it's in there a lot. But really, I think it's all about that class stuff to me.
Yeah. I mean, I have a stats on.
I love stats.
Well, this is again from the transcript of the case where the prosecutor says he counted out the novel's use of four-letter words. The word fuck or fucking appears no less than 30 times. Cunt 14 times, balls 13 times, shit and ass 6 times a piece, cock 4 times, piss 3 times, and so on.
I mean, that's the best ad that you can get for this book, really.
I know. Just have that on the cover in little quotes.
But I saw, I ended up kind of keeping a little bit of a tally when I was researching this about things that other white men said about this book.
Go on.
So you're talking about, you know, they said, you know, would you want your child or daughter to have
servant?
This? Yeah, or your servant.
Your servant.
And it said during a debate held in the House of Lords, one of the lords replied to that saying he had no such objection, but he would have the strongest objection to the book being read by his gamekeeper.
Yeah, I bet he would.
So I was like, that's quite good. And then in the US, a senator, Senator Smoot, said that Lady Chatterley's Lover was written by a man with a diseased mind and a soul so black that he would even obscure the darkness of hell.
Oof.
Wow.
That's dark.
I mean, I didn't get that from the book, I have to admit. Maybe I'll read it a third time. I'm not sure. Wow, that's so full on.
So something that, like, again, obviously I haven't read it, but as you mentioned, Tegan, earlier, it has attracted a lot of feminist critique.
Mm. And D.H. Lawrence was apparently right wing.
Oh.
In the end. So he just kind of, he didn't hate fascism.
Right.
I don't know if that's right wing.
I think that makes you right wing, yeah. Yeah. I think it's usually like the dead giveaway.
Yeah, I think his opinion on democracy has been described as lukewarm.
Right. Okay. Well.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. I mean, we don't want to ruin the book for you. Anyway, so I guess what I found interesting, kind of going back to this idea of there being a lack of foreplay in the book, something that came up just reading. I didn't want to like spoil it for myself too much, but I also wanted to like get a bit of a sense of like what the feminists were saying. And one of the things,
those pesky feminists,
I know, they weren't piped down.
They come in waves.
And so one of them was that there's this real focus on a very narrow idea, and I guess like I say this understanding that it was 1920, but that being said, we've read some filthy stuff from before then. Mm. So anyway, there's this idea that the sort of scope of the sex was very like limited to what was perceived by, what's the gamekeeper's name?
Mellors.
By Mellors.
Oliver Mellors.
Yeah, by Mellors' perception of what was like acceptable sex. And so kind of the idea is that that's reflective of D.H. Lawrence and what he, you know, believed to be, and kind of this idea of like the natural orgasm being the one which is the most acceptable, mm-hmm. to Mellors, that is, you know, a simultaneous penetrative orgasm,
this strange hatred, and it's filtered all throughout the book, this hatred of the clitoris in a way. He refers to it as this beak, that women have this beak down theirs. Yeah. And that to get themselves off, or to bring themselves off by themselves without men, that it was so low. He actually referred to it as being something that whores do, and it would their beak rubbed and tore at men.
Oh,
that's
God.
One of the things that he wrote. And he has this, it occurs twice, once with Oliver Mellors and with one of the lovers that Connie takes earlier in the book, is that it is seen as being this criminal thing, this truly cruel thing that women can do, which is they can allow men to basically orgasm within themselves, but they hold themselves back willfully. They choose not to take their pleasure from men in that way. But then afterwards, when a man has already finished, then they'll, you know, writhe and cry and all that sort of stuff and take their pleasure, you know, later. you know, via a clitoral orgasm.
I mean, look, if a man knew how to make me writhe in pleasure, then I would be happy to let him do it. It's a lot less work for me that way.
But it is seen as this withholding, that women actively choose to withhold this thing that would truly connect them, which is the joint orgasm, them coming together and bringing themselves to pleasure at the same time. The one thing I will say, and I really only picked up on it this time, because they're around pages, I've literally written them down, around the 200 mark, you have this big bit where Oliver Mellors is talking about his ex-wife and no, sorry, his wife. And it gets really weird. He's going on about the fact that she would withhold from him and yet that she would only get herself off by, you know, I think he might even use the word frigging or...
The term frigging is just not used enough anymore, I think.
It's just... And that he despised her and they would get into physical altercations. Like, there's definitely examples of domestic violence in there. But he's going through all of the women that he dated in the past and just like, she wouldn't come with me. She was cold towards sex. And this is the problem with women. Oh, they want Mellors. A man, but they don't want the sex. And it just goes on and on and on. And there's also a pretty racist line in there, which I bounce off in a big way. But then a few pages later, I noticed that Connie says something to him along the lines of, you don't really think that. And he says, don't I know what a broken-backed snake that's been trodden on I was. And I almost wonder if like, oh, were you venting? That was a shit vent. You just vented. Maybe not. Maybe I'm looking on it far too kindly, but it's like when you sit around with your girlfriends, it's like, he was fucked, and that's how he was fucked, and they were all fucked, and there was nothing good about
any of them. I couldn't make any of them come.
Yeah, right.
And I'm going to talk Story to you about how it made me feel shit.
And then, you know, and then 20 minutes later, you have another glass of wine, and your girlfriend's like, yeah, but, you know, Jeff was all right. And you're like, all right, Jeff was all right. Yeah, no, I was in a really bad place, and, you know, whatever. And I wonder if it was meant to be more of a scene like that, and we just read... Because this is what we do. We just break everything apart. We take it so literally. But yeah, the weird, the beak thing. I don't know who D.H. Lawrence slept with and what was going on down there.
I do just find it fascinating because the book itself kind of holds this place in this kind of narrative of like sexual revolution and becoming more sexually liberated and that becoming more and more acceptable. And I just find it interesting that it's like, yes, but only within this certain confine of what was deemed okay by D.H. Lawrence at the time.
Mm. Yeah, it's certainly not. I think that actually, Germaine Greer put it really wonderfully. She said, one thing the innocent reader will not learn from Lady Chatterley's lover is how to fuck. If you are a woman, you learn that you will do wild little cries, the same wild little cries that you will hear porn stars faking on every video. And she's certainly right. You won't learn how to fuck from this. Often Connie just lies there in some state of wonder or shock or being empty. She's so often just vacant of everything. And that will be written in that she just had nothing left in her at this particular moment. And then she will have this sexual moment and it changes everything. You know, she has sex with Mellors and as she's walking away, she's like, he's just put a baby in me and I know it for a fact, you know, and I don't know how accurate that is. But no, there is something in this about this woman discovering with all of the money and all of the noise that there was in the world that connection, that a physical connection between two people is important. And yeah, and some of the orgasm scenes are really great reads. I just want to actually talk on one other thing on the language, which is the language in Lady Chatterley's Lover gets spoken about a lot and people really head towards the cunt. I think that's, and I've tried to reclaim that word. I bristle, you know, you've probably talked about this already at length, the fact that there are so many horrible words about women and new ones coming up with even now in this modern age that just aren't reflected in an equally bad word for men.
Mm.
Even Karens, it's, you know, think what you want about the word Karens, but there's no male equivalent. TERF, there's no male equivalent to that. And I always like, oh, but where's the male one? But anyway, I've tried to reclaim cunt, but it's really jarring, this book. But oddly enough, that's not the thing that upsets me. It's the fact that he uses the term bowels in a way that must have felt different back in the 1920s. But she talks about awfully being moved in her bowels a lot and feeling sensations in her bowels and things feeling a flutter in her bowels.
Rather than like a stirring in the loins? Like you get a...
Yeah, no, it's not about the loins. It's all about their bowels.
Wow, right, okay.
Right? And I just can't... I mean, he talks about... At one point, he's stroking her ass And he said something along the lines of like, they're that and you, I can't even do
they're
it.
They're that
but
and
I know that they're that and something along the lines like, you shit and piss from those holes and I'm okay with it because I wouldn't want a woman who doesn't shit and piss from those holes and it's great. It's really right jarring. On. And just all the bowely pooiness of the whole thing, it just makes me feel like they get messy.
Because it's, there well, is a really, I mean, there's anal in
there
the
There is anal.
What?
Yeah, sorry, we should have led with the anal. So there's
that
anal
needs to go on the cover as well.
Because there's anal in the book, and at the time that it was written, it was illegal. Like, anal sex was illegal.
I actually missed it the first time. That's how vague it is.
Yeah, it's all in the bowels.
Oh, God.
No, it's also, that's one of the bits that really pisses off the feminists as well, because it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's painful for Connie and she had to be submissive to him and she wasn't sure if she liked it, but being taken in that way from him, you know, roused her and brought on new sensations she never thought she had. And it was this,
yeah, it did, Connie.
She thought that it would bring on shame, but actually it annihilated shame from her life, you know.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, fun. But anyway, yeah, language, bowels. It's jarring.
So, I mean, the last little fact that I have, little factoid about the book itself is that it was sold at auction, I think, maybe in the 90s. I can't remember, but the book used by the trial judge in the obscenity case was sold at auction. And it was sold for £56,250 by an overseas bidder. And then the arts minister at the time placed a temporary ban preventing its export because people were like, this is an English artwork and should stay in England. And so
heritage.
Yeah.
That's interesting that they would swing the other way and be like, no, it's fine now, we want to keep it.
Yeah. And it's because of all of the obscenity laws that came up around it and, you know, the whole mythology of it now. Mm. But yeah, pretty crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I thought a nice way to wrap this up would just be doing a little bit of learning about the word cunt. I really like the word cunt. I used to not like it when I was younger. I think I was still a bit like shy around the idea of it, but I quite like it, especially when it's used in a sexy way. I don't like it used as an insult as much, but
what about how do you feel about it being used as like a friendly term?
You are a fully sick cunt.
How do you feel? I mean, when Tegan says it, I feel great.
Especially when there's a real awkward pause afterwards.
I don't know how I feel. Anyway, so the origins of the word cunt is pretty like contested. Everyone, you know, it's like Lamingtons. Everyone wants to claim
like
that.
Just like Lamingtons.
So
yeah, but we're the ones that put coconut on the cunt, so it's definitely ours.
So I think you'll find cunt is Australian.
So supposedly it's either based on the Latin word for sword sheath, which is cunnus.
Boo.
or cunnius, which means triangular wedge.
So is this the same where cunnilingus comes from?
I would assume that would be in there somewhere.
So it's either the sword sheath or the triangular wedge.
Yeah, apparently. But there was also this Hindu goddess called, and I don't know exactly how it's pronounced, Kunti or Kunti, I'm not sure. Or the
I hope it's Kunti. The goddess Kunti.
The great yoni of the universe. She appeared in this like major epic Sanskrit work in ancient India between 200 and 400 BC. And I looked it up and there's some like pretty cool imagery of this like amazing Kunti goddess.
I like this one. This one's my favorite.
Yeah,
so
yeah. I'm a fan of this. Fuck the Latin. Fuck you guys. Fuck Romans.
Well, and then so going from that in the Middle Ages and like Christianity, they would like preach this idea of women's genitals being like a potent source of evil. And they would call it the cunnus diaboli. I can't say it. Diaboli. Cunnus diaboli or devilish cunt. So like it's sort of
now
runs
that's
through.
That's a term I like.
Devilish cunt.
You've got a devilish cunt.
Actually, I don't mind it either.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Here we go.
And then, of course, Shakespeare kind of worked it into some of his works as well, as it started to become more...
Yeah, where did Shakespeare say cunt?
Well, so in Hamlet says...
I did study that in year 12.
Well, it's because he didn't use the word cunt because it still held... I mean, obviously, like, D.H. Lawrence hadn't come along yet to solve that problem. So he would use it in other ways. Like, for example, Hamlet says, "Do you think I mean country matters?" Followed by, "It's a fair thought to lie between a maid's legs." So this idea that country matters is he's actually given a little hat tip to...
Shakespeare, what a devilish cunt.
Yeah. So that's just a little trip down the history cunt of lane. Cunt. Cunt lane.
There you go. Yeah, no, the princess, warrior princess one, that one was... That's my vote.
Yeah, I agree.
I feel like we as the cunt bearers, we should get to choose where the word comes from.
Yeah, no, I stand
by that.
And
can we also eradicate cunny purse from the history of everything? Because when I finally put two and two together on that and realised what it was, it was a very upsetting day for me.
Cunny purse?
I don't think
Have you not heard of a cunny purse?
No.
So when women had to, they've got their shillings or whatever it was, they would put it in a little purse that was hidden in their cunnies.
Oh. I mean, were they secret coins? Like, why would I?
Why is it kind of like there with you. Putting your weed in your vagina?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Was that what it was meant to be doing? Hang on, where has that come from? I didn't know that's where we're putting it. But you're putting it in biscuits.
It's nature's pocket. It's nature's pocket.
Wow. Okay. And on that note, let's leave it there. Thank you, Tegan, so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. And eventually when your book is published, we look forward to reading it.
Yeah. We'll spruik it to our 340 followers.
Yay. Well, if you ever, worry that I've, tried to class it up too much, I promise you this will be the hot, chippiest, trash baggiest of books. And this is why I can prove it to you. The working title is The Storm Between Us.
Oh.
What garbage. It's going to be amazing.
That sounds so good.